try to trick God. Like, I don't think you can trick him. So put that.
This is CKUW 95.9 FM, where programming is made by, for, and about the Winnipeg community.
Segment of our show, Sarnia Mayor Mike Bradley will be giving us an insight into the issues of poverty and disability. So, as we enter into 2025, how are the issues of poverty and disability likely to manifest?
Well, it's ongoing, and the battle gets tougher with the economy and just other priorities by governments, and that makes it very, very challenging in these times.
So, have there been any successes this past year in terms of economic growth for the disability community that you've witnessed?
I cannot say that, Cam, that there's been a lot. Again, everyone's sort of hunkered down just trying to maintain what we have. I mean, we always keep pushing. We always keep on pushing governments. But I'd point out today that there's a cabinet shuffle going on, and the disability issue is not even on the radar. There's not even a minister totally responsible for that portfolio and disability employment. And it's sort of just left off to the side, both provincially and federally. And there's not recognition of how important a recognition is and how there's a skilled workforce out there that is ignored.
So, in your own city of Sarnia, you've taken steps in the past to encourage the disability workforce to become more normalized, for employers to include workers with disabilities. Have you taken any further steps to that end this past year?
No, what we've continued to do, though, is continue to maintain, especially on student employment, high level of disability employment, and sending a message to the rest of the employers in the community that this is a good thing to do for your business, it's a smart thing to do. And that's, again, something I'd like to point to. I cannot talk to any new initiatives, only because, again, the timing with the economy and just the way business is right now, just trying to hold on to what they have, it's a bigger challenge to try to come up with something that's going to appeal to them.
So, in that sense, why do you think it is that leaders should be taking a closer look at the disability issue and making it more of a priority?
Well, it's really simple to me. It's a civil rights issue. That's what it is. Can't guise it the way they used to, that it's charity, it's a civil rights issue. I did a podcast just a few weeks ago with David Onley's son and a number of other advocates, and so we haven't given up the battle. We are just looking at a new direction, and how do we keep on pushing governments? We're going to probably have a change at the federal level. I'm not sure how that's going to work out for people with disabilities, because so far, you look at, there were promises made in the last election to increase the benefits, and they didn't get increased to anywhere near where they should be for people to have a livable life, and that is the challenge. The advocacy is good from different sectors and different groups to push for this, but we really need the disability community to speak up and say we're voters, and we need to be recognized.
So it's interesting you raised the matter of how it was previously seen as charitable. Isn't there a distinct advantage to an employer who would take on someone with a disability in terms of new insight and the possibility of attracting more business from people with disabilities?
And that has always been, Cam, the pitch that we've made. This is the smart thing to do. It'll increase your business. And as you look, and even look at my own community, the number of people are aging. We're talking probably at some point we're going to have like 30-40% of the communities with people with disabilities who need service, who need access physically. And it's a smart business thing to do. And you know, you get a lot of lip service when you say that, but I think we just need to be stronger on that. Do you want more customers? Do you want more people coming into your business? Then look at what you need to do to facilitate the people that are a big part of your market.
So are there any steps that the public can take to get better educated or better armed in terms of a knowledge base when it comes to these matters?
Well, I'd refer the public, if they're interested, is to go to the Ontario Disability Employment Network, which I work with very closely, and they have a number of initiatives underway working right across the province. And they have a base there of information I think people will find quite interesting. Well, what is happening? And what is happening in a positive way using ODIN as the facilitator of that information?
So what would be the ideal outcome for the year ahead if you could see anything happen to improve the situation for individuals with disabilities and their role in the economy? What would it be?
Well, in Ontario, it looks like we're going to have a provincial election and we're going to have a federal election, which is mandated. I would hope during those elections we can make this an issue. And if not, we'd be prepared after those elections to go to the new governments of the day and say, look, this is a priority for many communities as we age in place and disabilities appear with people. And here's an opportunity to show leadership and not just to do it one day a year when they issue a proclamation or declare whatever day it is. It's to do something real and deep. And the benefit, the payback, will come back both to Ontario and to the federal government.
Wouldn't it also come down to a matter of monitoring? It's fine to get the policies and the infrastructure in place, but we'd have to have a mandate to regularly be checked on to make sure that these policies are enforced or these systems are providing all they can for persons with disability.
I would agree, and I can tell you when working with Mark Wafer and Joe Dale with Rotary at Work, David Onley, when we had a really big meeting here with a lot of business people invited, the key was to make sure there was follow-up back to those businesses directly to say, okay, you've heard the pitch, what are you going to do? And monitoring, instead of just, you know, sending stuff out there and hoping for the best, it is critical, because then you can use that information to make the case even better with other businesses and governments.
I'd thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you. Thanks, Ken.
Of course. In this segment of our show, Bruce Crosby and Quinn Tang will be telling us about wheelchair rugby. So what can you tell me about your work with wheelchair rugby?
I'm actually a player with wheelchair rugby, and I have been on the board as well, on and off over the years. Player-wise, is absolutely the best experience for someone with a high-level injury. And being on the board is just really rewarding, because we get to sort our funding and get new players to be interested and get new chairs to really experience this sport.
So, for a player with a high-level injury, what are some of the benefits of keeping active?
There's so many benefits from keeping active. For example, for someone like myself, I'm a C67 quadriplegic. Normally, I just sit in front of a computer and do my work. But when I get to play wheelchair rugby, I can feel my heart rate increasing. I can feel, and normally for a quadriplegic, we're cold all the time. But when I play rugby, I actually feel warm all over my body. And the energy level, I can keep up with my 6-year-old kid being in the gym or being outside, as well as the benefit of being around people who are very much like myself and learning from them all the tricks in life. For example, how to get on a chair once you fall off, other things that if you're having so much pain, nerve pain, how can you overcome that, not with only medication, but mind over body, etc. So those are some of the great benefits of someone with a high level that can play when they get to play wheelchair rugby.
So how does the sport itself compare with the able-bodied equivalent?
My coach is ready. I'm just going to get him to... Sorry, can you repeat that question?
So, how does the sport of wheelchair rugby compare and contrast with the able-bodied equivalent?
I'm going to get Bruce to answer that question because he's been with the sport for his for my entire career of wheelchair rugby, which is over, I don't know, 15 years. Bruce?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Kevin, do you mind asking that question to Bruce?
Absolutely. How does the sport of wheelchair rugby compare and contrast with the able-bodied equivalent?
Well, it doesn't. It, outside of being a team sport, the number of athletes that play on a court at one time is different. There's only four. It's able-bodied rugby is played on a field. It's it uses a rugby ball. Ours is more of a basketball. Hockey kind of hybrid thing, and it's played on an indoor basketball court. And you only play with four players at a time. So, they used rugby because they couldn't use the name murder ball, you know. So,
Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, have you heard of the name murder ball being used before, Cameron?
Yes, I have, actually.
Yes. So it sounds so exciting for those players on the court that call it murder ball. But for those people who are not familiar with the sport, it actually scares them away.
Yeah.
Especially female players. So I have been on the recruiting side for female players. And as soon as I mention the word murder ball, they're like, you're nuts. You're crazy. And the family members who are pampering, once we have a disability, they're pampering us like little babies. As soon as they hear the word murder ball, oh no, my kid is definitely not enjoying the sport.
Exactly.
And then something else is different, that it's a hybrid sport. So wheelchair rugby is more like taking wheelchair basketball, wheelchair hockey, sit volleyball, I believe, and played on a basketball court, where real rugby is played on, grass, which our wheelchair cannot play on such a field because our wheel will be stuck and it will just shred our shoulders. Oops. And so we're playing on, sorry, Bruce, go ahead.
On a soft feel, yes, yeah.
So when we play on a basketball, we can really get some speed for those of us with a higher level of disability, and then we can really hit each other hard. So that's the really exciting part about wheelchair rugby, that we get to hit each other with our chairs, and it's legal.
So is there ever a risk that in the hitting and the collision there'd be any damage to the equipment itself?
The equipment is made for contact, so the amount of money that you put into it, there's been great designers, there's been great producers of the wheelchairs that allow them to last longer and take the hits longer, but the name of the game is contact, right? So they're chair on chair hits.
So one last question for each of you. In your time with the sport, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you?
There's always been, a success story. For me, it was getting involved in the sport and seeing it grow within the province of Alberta, back in the early 2000s, to see the inclusion of women in the sport, mainly that the event that happened in Paris a couple of years ago, to see athletes from Alberta on the Canadian national team mainly like Zach Vidal, who won his very first one of Canada's very first Paralympic medals. So, but it's always things like that that, you know, in my mind are important to me and the sport, you know.
And for myself, I have two success stories, all for myself, of course. One is, I love the sport so much, is that 3 months after I gave birth to my baby, I came back and played in my first rugby tournament. And then I took a couple years off. You know, I have to watch my kid. And then I came back just last year to play in the sport because there's so many benefits that I missed while I was away from the sport. And so I needed to come back to feel that adrenaline pumping, feel that rugby sport family who is so supportive of us when we're in need. And the last one, maybe three, is that I did go to Germany and played in the world's first women's rugby tournament. It's a smaller version than what happened last year, but it was awesome to see so many women in Europe that loves this sport as much as I do.
Like, thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks. Andy Lank will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Are you a musician interested in getting your work recognized? How about being played on the radio and getting paid for it? Registered SOCAN members can receive royalties each time their songs are played on various media forms like radio, TV, or films. What is SOCAN? SOCAN is the Society of Composers, Authors, and Music Publishers of Canada, the Canadian copyright collective that administers performing rights for over 90,000 members. For more information on how to get placed with your music, register at SOCAN.com.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Sarnia Mayor Mike Bradley told us a little bit about his hopes for disability employment for the year ahead. And we heard a little bit about wheelchair rugby from Quinn Tang and Bruce Crosby. Now, this next interview is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Andrew Miner will be telling us about the YWHAG Foundation. So what's the latest with the foundation?
Again, thank you for, you know, reaching out. I appreciate it. You know, I believe we spoke about a year ago. So, you know, just been really continuing on the path that I was with, you know, trying to find, you know, better treatment for our kids and, you know, for our specific rare disease, which is the YWHAG genetic mutation. And it's, you know, where our kids have a mutation in that gene that causes them to not have enough of the protein called gamma. And so, you know, we tried, you know, we're actively pursuing drug repurposing with the hope that we can find a drug to, you know, increase, you know, the expression of the gene and have them have more usable copies of that gamma protein in their body. And that's, you know, we have identified, you know, a few good candidates, but additional testing still needed. So, you know, it's hard to be in the waiting process for that. But, you know, we have another researcher who we've identified that's, you know, was kind enough to help help us continue the research and, you know, I guess look more in depth at it than, you know, kind of what the company that we're working with is doing. So that's, you know, kind of hopeful. And, you know, we've just really been trying to expand our research network and just get additional interest in our rare disease. And that's, you know, it's, we've been successful, but it's, you know, I feel like there's always more that can be done. And, you know, it's always hard, you know, just everything takes time and money, and that's hard to do.
So for those who might have missed our prior interview,
Mm-hmm. How does that disease typically affect a person?
It's very, you know, I'd say 99% of the patients, you know, follow this course. Is that, you know, everything, you know, it's a normal birth, normal, you know, everything's normal. And in the first approximate 6 months to 2 years is when, you know, the kids' symptoms of epilepsy appear, and they have, you know, their first episode, which was very much the case with my son. And, you know, no one in my family has epilepsy. So, you know, it was a horrifying experience. I wasn't sure what was happening to my son. And that kind of sent us out down this path, you know, of, you know, diagnosis and, you know, just learning about this rare disease and how nothing's being done. So we have to, I guess, chart our own path, if you will. But the, for this, for my son and the YWHAG genetic mutation, you know, it's epilepsy, you know, developmental delays, intellectual disabilities, challenges with, you know, fine motor skills, you know, a lot of kids are on the spectrum for autism, you know, just, you know, speech delays, behavioral issues, fine motor issues, gait issues, which, you know, could be kind of classified under weakness with a, you know, muscle weakness. Yeah, I think that's kind of it in a nutshell.
So with the host of symptoms you described, is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis?
I can only speak from my experience, Cam. What I can tell you is that I was surprised at, I hope things have gotten better, but, you know, from, you know, being in the hospital for the first time when my son was 6 months old, it took us a year to get, genetic testing. And at that, we really had to push our doctor for it. And, you know, to me, it was very surprising how non-invasive it was. It was basically a Q-tip swab in our mouth. And, you know, my wife, myself, and my son were all tested. So it was quite surprising that it took us a year to get a diagnosis. And, I think genetic testing's come a long way, and I think that's really helpful. And I've seen a lot of patients in our community that have joined our group that are older now that have gotten genetic testing, and it helps really answer some questions. So I don't know if misdiagnosis is as prevalent as maybe no diagnosis or, you know, unknown reasons for us. But again, I can only speak from, you know, kind of my experience, what I see in our community.
So in your time with the foundation, is there any success story, recent memory, that stands out for you?
Yes, I would say, you know, I wish I could say that, you know, I found, you know, a cure or a better treatment, but I've really learned along the way that you just have to keep being persistent. And I could say, you know, our work in fundraising and getting, you know, cells for researchers to be able to study, has, you know, that was a lot of hard work to raise money to get that. But, you know, since we've had those cells available, we've gotten 4 different researchers across the country that have put it into their lab and are studying, you know, various aspects of this rare disease. And specifically, the one researcher in Alabama is really kind of taking an in-depth look at this genetic mutation and, you know, how drugs might help them. So it's, I guess for me, you know, it's not an immediate success, but, you know, we have the so this researcher was kind enough to take it upon himself to study our rare disease. And, you know, otherwise it would have I'd say, be unattainable because it would cost tens and tens of thousands of dollars the work he's doing. So in my mind, that's a huge success, and I hope that it yields results, and, you know, sooner rather than later.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks. Mike was absolutely right, in so much as the disability workforce is largely untapped, at least to its full potential. It only makes business sense for employers to want to take on individuals with disabilities, not just for the innovations and the new ideas they bring to the table, which they do in many cases, because they know what works for them. They know an effective and direct way of getting things done in a way that suits their abilities and their capabilities. But also because you're creating a disability-friendly atmosphere. Your business becomes known as a place where the disability community is not only included, but welcomed and encouraged to take part in, to do business. Chances are that's going to be a place that individuals with disabilities will frequent and come back to. Most people aren't so inclined to go to a place where it's not geared to their needs and their wants. As consumers, individuals with disabilities have every right to shop and to dine and what have you in a place that's accessible and inclusive, and seeing people like themselves with similar experience, similar capability, creates sort of an unspoken mental ease, I think. So much as consumers like knowing that it isn't just a place that welcomes them as patrons, but also a place that welcomes their brethren as workers, a place that really does value equality. It's easy for a business to say all the right things, to say we want to be more inclusive, we want to be more accessible. The question is, was, and ever shall be, if you can make your physical space environment accessible, what's the next step? You can certainly get a worker or a patron in the door, but is it a place they want to stay? Is it a place they'll be comfortable coming back to, maybe even spreading the word about, to other individuals with disabilities? In the business world, they are around to make money, to survive, and to thrive. For individuals with disabilities, yes, that same need exists, maybe with a few more medical expenses. But the truth is, you don't want to overcomplicate the process. You don't want to be talking about inclusion on the one hand, and doing everything in your power to say we only want certain types of people in here on the other. For the fact is, you don't grow as a consumer base by always gearing to the same ideals. And you certainly don't grow in a mindset by only thinking the same way. If you choose to look at individuals with disabilities as a group that you want to welcome in, that is the beginning. Ask the question of what can we do to ensure that our business, our school, whatever it is, it's a place that everyone can enjoy and appreciate. For a person with a disability brings much to the table. Most of all, they bring a need to be included and understood. And that is a basic human right. It's what we all long for. Just don't create factions in the disability community. Just look at it as disability is a great thread that weaves through the fabric of every community. Recognizing that, you come to realize we're all coming from the same place, just the need to be valued. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.